Okay, so here we go. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, when you mention contemplating or reflecting, can you please advise when do we do it? And when you talked about contemplating, if we have a certain craving, when do we contemplate? During or after meditation session? Thank you, Vimita. Okay, so contemplation is an important part of the Buddhist practice, and it takes many different forms. One obvious type of contemplation is just to reflect on the suttas, right? You read the word of the Buddha, and then you think about it afterwards. What does it actually mean? How do I practice this? What does it mean to me personally? And you try to read a positive message in there which actually works for you, which has meaning for you. Things that don't make any sense to you, that you can't really incorporate in your life, you can just leave those to one side and not worry about them. Take those teachings that actually work for you. In other words, those that help you to feel better, to reduce the defilements, to increase your sense of well-being, those are the kind of teachings that are worthwhile. The Buddha always said, we need to reflect on these things, we need to bring it to mind. And after a while, either we tend to gain confidence in those teachings as a consequence of that. And this is one way of reflecting, and it's very worthwhile and very powerful, and brings us already forward on the path. Then there is other ways of reflecting, some of these reflections, I will talk about them later on, but there are like themes of the Dhamma you can reflect on. Somebody mentioned the other day the five types of contemplation, like everything dear and pleasing to me must become otherwise, must part from me one day. And the idea behind this is not to make you sad or depressed, right? Oh, everything must go. No, it's rather to just realize that you cannot hold on to these things too hard. And when you realize that, it actually makes you peaceful. It has a beautiful effect if you do it in the right way. It makes you peaceful because you detach. And then when you sit down in meditation, you feel a sense of freedom, a sense of burden having been abandoned, because you're no longer responsible for all of these things. You're no longer the owner of these things. These things, you're happy to just let them go according to their own existence and their own trajectory, so to speak. So this is how you reflect, right? Very often it is useful to, when you meditate, to choose before you meditate what you are going to do. This meditation, I'm going to sit down and just be peaceful, right? And then another meditation, maybe you go outside, you do some walking. You can walk in the forest, or you can do walking meditation back and forth or whatever. And that is often a good time to reflect. And you can bring up some theme. Okay, this kind of theme about everything, or everything is impermanent. All of these things, dear and pleasing to me, must change. And see what that does to you. See what it does to your mind. And always, this is one of those very crucial questions to ask when you do a contemplation. Does it work for me? Does it have any results? If you find it is just too difficult, you actually feel depressed or sad about it, please don't do it. Forget about it. Don't do that. Do something else. Only do those things that work, right? This is not a purpose here, isn't to torture you, to make you feel bad about things. The purpose is to develop the mind in a wholesome direction. Then it is good. Then it is positive. Then you will deepen your meditation and your sense of well-being. That is the purpose of all of this. You can also do metta meditation while you're walking. You can, doing metta meditation, you can just walk back and forth. You can visualize like a certain direction, all the beings in a certain direction, to the north of here. And if you already are settling down and you're feeling peaceful and good, you can send the good, the kind of the goodness of your heart toward all those beings. May all those beings out there, may you be well, may you be happy. You send this beautiful well-wishing to all beings, human, animals, whatever it is, in the northern direction from here. So this is the sort of thing you can do while walking meditation, or you can do it while you're sitting down. And you can also do contemplations about specific people. If there are specific people that you're having problems with in ordinary life, now is a good opportunity to send them your well-wishing, to let go of any anger or ill will that you may have towards those people. You can contemplate death, right? Remind yourself that you're going to die. This can also make you very peaceful if you do it in the right way. all of these things are very suitable contemplations, but decide, do one or the other, right? Have some idea beforehand. Don't mix too many things together in one meditation session. These are various ways. Another way of contemplating, which I also recommend you to do, and this has to do with insight, to understanding about your own mind. This is also very useful. This is really what is called satipatthana in the Buddhist teachings. And one of the things that you have to learn gradually as part of Buddhist meditation is to understand the defilements and the blockages in your own mind. Because these are ultimately the things that hinder you from making progress in meditation. So at the end of the meditation, you ask yourself, right? You look back on what you have been doing and you ask yourself, what were the hindrances here? What were the things that blocked me? You ask yourself what actually worked, what perceptions develop the meditation, but also ask yourself, what were the blockages there? What stopped me from going deeper? And if your meditation has a certain degree of clarity, you will be able to see what is going on. You have some idea what's going on. With training, you will see these things. And what you will see that, you know, maybe usually the two biggest problems in meditation is maybe a slight degree of ill will, right, of negativity, a very weak degree of that. Or the most fundamental of all the hindrances is the attachment to the five senses and to the body, to the world outside. It's just too hard to let go of that. These are the two most fundamental hindrances on the path. And that is where we need to have insight into our own mind, how it works. So contemplate that. Look at your mind. What are the blockages? The other hindrances are ill will and sloth. No, not ill will. Restlessness and sloth and torpor, and also doubt, but these are like subsidiary, and these are often a function of the sensual desires and the ill will. They come as a consequence of that. So if you focus on the first two, you're already doing pretty much what you have to do. And this is this is where we need insight early on in the meditation path, because this is what blocks the development of samadhi. And only later on do we focus on those profound insights that have to do with uncovering the nature of reality. That type of insight comes after samadhi. Before samadhi, the important insights are the insights into the defilements themselves. Right? So spend a bit of time trying to understand the blockages in your meditation. This is detailed at great length in the Satipatthana Sutta, especially the last of the Satipatthanas. It says, understand sensual desire, right? Even understanding it is quite difficult because it comes in so many forms, sometimes incredibly subtle. You wouldn't even have known that this was a sensual desire because it's so subtle. Slight attachment to the body, this kind of things. And you understand how it arises, where it comes from, what its origin is, right? It has to do with regarding something as beautiful. And when you regard something as beautiful, as nice, then sensual desire will arise in regard to that object. Oh, my body, right? I'm attached to my body here. And you understand how it's abandoned, how when you abandon the cause which gives rise to it, how it stays away. So all of these things you start to see happening in your own mind. This is the type of insight, the type of contemplation that is very useful if you want to move towards samadhi. Then when you eventually get to samadhi, then you can start thinking about the deeper insights. Okay, so these are some of the suggestions, but please try to kind of compartmentalize your practice. Okay, now I'm doing the stillness meditation. After you come out of that meditation, then you reflect what was actually happening, right? How did it work? How didn't it work? And slowly, slowly, you start uncovering this. For many of you, it may just be enough just to do the stillness meditation. It takes quite a bit of clarity to see what's going on in the mind. So even if you just do the stillness meditation, just feeling peaceful, feeling quiet, watching the breath a little bit, right? That's good enough. If it makes you feel better, that's wonderful already. So it really depends on where you're at and what your requirements are. So you have to experiment a little bit with that. Okay, so I hope that helps. So see what happens. Dear Ajahn, what is the best form of life? to hear and practice the Dhamma? Is it in the Deva heaven or as a human being? So what is the best type of place to be, to hear the Dhamma? Is it as a Deva or is it as a human being? So the suttas, the Buddha doesn't really say this very much. What he says is that being an animal is not very useful. That's very bad if you want to understand the Dhamma. If you're a kangaroo, you're not going to understand very much of the Dhamma, unfortunately. So human beings is pretty good. One of the advantages of the human realm is that there is a, you know, human realm is a kind of a mixture of happiness and suffering, right? There are problems in the human realm. There's also happinesses. And that kind of fact that there is a fair amount of trouble, difficulties in living as a human being makes it, gives you a motivation to practice the spiritual life, practice the spiritual path. So for that reason, the human realm is often said to be a good place to practice Dhamma, to hear the Dhamma, etc., etc. But on the other hand, when you read the word of the Buddha, it is also quite clear that there were many devas, heavenly beings, who also had experiences of the Dhamma, who heard the teachings, and who had good results as a consequence of that, even attained stages of awakening, attained jhanas and these kind of things. So it isn't impossible to practice in the heavenly realm, but it is a little bit more difficult. I don't know if you can be a monastic in heaven. I think that's probably not possible. You can't. It's hard to get ordained in the heavenly realm. So sometimes people think, oh, should I desire to be a human being in the future? Should I try to direct my mind or whatever? And I always think the best thing to do is just to allow your karma to take its course. Allow things to happen according to how you have developed your mind. Don't try too hard. And I want to be a human being because the human realm is the best one. Sometimes we just end up messing up the whole process if we try to control things. And it's very hard at the end of the day to really know what is best and what isn't. So just make the very best of this life, and then you will be ready regardless of where you get reborn next time. Okay. Okay, so let's have a look at this. This is just a suggestion, I think, that somebody suggests that everybody should take only one plate for breakfast and one plate for lunch, because that will reduce the dishwashing here. So maybe that's a good idea. So anyway, that's a suggestion here. Just use few plates, as I think is the idea is here. Okay, very good. Okay, so see what happens. There's no guarantee that this is going to happen, right? Just because you think it's a good idea, so don't be disappointed if it doesn't happen. It's just life sometimes takes its own course. So you just have to allow that. Okay. Dear Ajahn, how does one develop the perception of beauty in silence? Okay, so it's quite easy, right? When things become silent, what does it feel like when things become silent? It's nice, isn't it? Isn't that beautiful? Things are calming down and things are becoming quiet. You feel this retreat center here. You feel that you are away from all the burdens of ordinary life. You feel the peace around you. You sit in your room with 60 people and it's hardly noise. Everybody is enjoying the silence. Isn't that a wonderful thing? And just feel the silence. The silence is both inside you and outside of you. And as you feel that, as you experience that, whoa, it becomes more powerful as a consequence. If you have a lot of thinking going on, maybe that's what you are talking about, I'm not sure. If you have a lot of thinking going on, just focus, see, there will be moments there when your mind is peaceful and quiet. Focus on that. Feel those beautiful, quiet moments. Right? Wow, this is really nice. This is wonderful. Silence is so much more powerful, so much more beautiful than all the thinking going on in the mind. The thinking is a pain in the backside, and the silence is a... is actually very, it's not that hard to see the beauty of the silence. Just keep on looking for it, and if you keep on looking for it, you will be able to see that it's there. Very often it's just a matter of seeing that simplicity itself is very nice, right? The more simple things are, often the better they are. Understanding the absence of things, the Buddha has this beautiful idea of seeing emptiness in things. He talks about focus on the emptiness. This is one of the suttas, the Chula Sunyata Sutta, the shorter sutta on emptiness. And there he starts off by saying, you know, you start off by focusing on the perception of forest. You're a forest monk, you're sitting in the forest, and that perception is empty of all the noise and all the things of ordinary life. There's no village, no people, no chariots, no horses, and all this kind of stuff. That was in those days. These days it's much worse, right? Much worse things going on. So you focus on that emptiness, the sense that all of these things are not there. And then you see, wow, how nice that is, this perception of things lacking. And then you take that emptiness deeper, the forest disappears, and all you have is like the breath or something like that, right? There's no building, there's nothing here, all the people around you, everything disappears. And then the breath disappears, you go even deeper. And each one of these is like, the Buddha calls it a descent into emptiness, things becoming more and more empty, less and less things there. And you see how beautiful that is when things become empty. Emptiness sounds kind of scary to begin with, until you start to experience for yourself and you start to see, wow, actually it is very nice and very beautiful. Okay, so good luck with that and see what happens. Okay, dear Ajahn, please would you clarify at Sanghita Nikaya 12.1, with the cessation of ignorance comes the cessation of sankharas. With the cessation of sankharas comes the cessation of consciousness. But an arahant has consciousness, so it is cessation of a certain conditioned consciousness or rebirth consciousness. Or does the arahant see consciousness cease with much metta? And a nice smiley face on the end there, which is nice. Okay, so what happens here is that the consciousness in the third link of dependent origination, it really refers to the rebirth consciousness. It is a bit tricky because the way I have been talking about it is I say that your sankharas, your volitions, they affect your consciousness here and now, right? But strictly speaking, the consciousness independent arising is really about the rebirth consciousness. It does affect the consciousness here and now, but then that consciousness here and now is what leads you to a particular rebirth in the future, consciousness continuing on in that way. So strictly speaking, independent arising is sankhara paccavijnana, means sankharas in this life, because they affect consciousness in this life, that will affect consciousness once you get reborn, right? So that is the rebirth consciousness. And this is how precisely what you say is quite right. An arahant is conscious, so because an arahant is conscious, you can be fairly sure that must refer to the rebirth consciousness. Otherwise, as soon as the sankhara, avijja ceases, sankhara ceases, consciousness goes, and you're gone straight away, but you're not. Arahants obviously exist in the world. They obviously have consciousness, so that can't be the case. And if you will have seen the definition of consciousness in the dependent arising was the six classes of consciousness, and that's all consciousness is included in that. So it's not just a particular type of conditioned consciousness, anything like that. All consciousness seems to be included in that. Okay, so that is my understanding of that, and so there you are. Okay. Dear Ajahn, I am determined to practice the Buddhist path until the end of my life. Okay, that's wonderful. However, I'm not sure that I will be a stream enter. Indeed, that is very true. You have a good point there. Will there be any assurance that I'll hear the Dhamma in my next life? Or is there only a possibility to it? Okay, so this is an interesting question, and as usual, there is always a reply to everything in the sutta. The suttas contain so much stuff, and you have to read them from one end to the other one to know everything that's in there. And there is a nice answer to that in the suttas. And the suttas say that if you want to maximize your chances of hearing the Dhamma in your next life, what you should do is to understand the Dhamma to the best of your ability in this life, right? And what you and by Dhamma, we don't mean kind of, you know, people giving talks, right? Or, you know, me saying kind of stuff and my interpretation or anyone else for that matter. What we mean by Dhamma is the word of the Buddha himself. When you understand the word of the Buddha, because that is what people in any realm, anywhere, will tend to have remembered, right? They will remember the word of the Buddha. This is the core, this is the essence of what Buddhism is about. So if you understand the word of the Buddha, then the chances are you go somewhere else, the word of the Buddha will come back to you and you will recognize it. And this is one of the reasons why it is so useful to actually not just listen to Dhamma talks by, you know, all kinds of teachers, because that is often very idiosyncratic. One teacher will teach in one way, another teacher will teach in a different way, and sometimes you don't know, you know, who is teaching right or wrongly, or whether it accords with the word of the Buddha, whatever. Sometimes it's very hard to make it out. But if you use the word of the Buddha as your basis, then that is something you will be able to recognize in the future. The idiosyncratic teachings of individual teachers, much more difficult to recognize in the future, because other people will not have heard them, they won't really be available in the same way here. So this is the way to do that, and this is why it is so useful to actually read the word of the Buddha, to understand it a bit more deeply. What are actually these Four Noble Truths? What is going on there? What is meant by sukha and dukkha? What is this all about? What is the Noble Eightfold Path? You know, how do we practice these things? And then when you realize in the future, whether it is in the human realm or the Deva realm, you will listen, right? Wow, I've heard this somewhere else before. I wonder where. It's like a déjà vu experience, right? People talk about déjà vu experience. Now you know where they come from. They come from the past lives, right? You had some perception of Buddhism in the past life. Now it is like a déjà vu in your future life. Wow, I know this. Right? This is what happened to me in many ways. I grew up in partly in Norway and other places as well, actually. But I had this interest in kind of traveling to Asia when I was young. And I went to Asia. I went to Japan the first time when I was a student. And I read my first book on Buddhism. And I went to Buddhist monasteries and I recognized things. I started to meditate soon afterwards. And I've always wondered, where does this all come from, right? What is it that drives me towards this? Then I wanted to go to a monastery. Why on earth did I want to go to a monastery for? It's kind of weird. It's inexplicable. My parents weren't Buddhist. They didn't have any Buddhist friends, nothing. I would like this one person kind of going his own way. And for me, the only way I can explain it must be some past life connection. Probably been a Buddhist monk in a past life. Don't know where, but, you know, probably somewhere in Asia or something. But, you know, that's really the only way I can explain this. And this is what you see also in the suttas. Once you have that, it will tend to carry on into the future here. So that is the way. But it is never absolutely sure. You can only kind of maximize the chances. Okay, dear Ajahn Ramali, thank you for your effort and patience in getting these important lessons of dependent oration across to us and helping us see the interconnectedness of things. Sadhu for the insights. And we are barely halfway through. That's right, yeah. So it goes very fast. So from here on, it will be slightly different, but that's good. Okay, very good. I'm glad you are appreciative. That's always nice. Okay, dear Ajahn, if you examine the teachings of modern-day sages from the Advaita Vedanta tradition, it appears evident that they taught not self as vigilantly as the Buddha. For example, the Maharar speaks repeatedly of I am as being the primary delusion that must be lost if one is to awaken to how things ultimately are. The lives of these sages are well documented, and they appear as free of taints from the sense of self as the Arahant counterparts in Buddhist tradition. To suggest that they are deluded because they confuse ultimate reality with higher dana is a bold claim, especially if one is not familiar with their writings. The Buddha alluded to unmanifest or unestablished consciousness in a few places, and it does not appear inconsistent with Advaitic universal non-dual awareness. Perhaps he did not delve much into the topic because it is so subtle and prone to misunderstanding, as it was always alleged by Brahmins in his time, e.g. as an eternal soul that lasts forever, with metta and respect. This is going to be very difficult to really, to answer and to reply to, because these things are very, very subtle points, and it really, you have to examine these teachers in great detail to see exactly what they say, to know what they're talking about, and all of these things. So it's very, very hard to really make a claim about this and to say one way or another. But remember that these things are very, very subtle. And the difference often, from an ordinary person's perspective, the difference between a deep state of samadhi and a realization of the Dhamma is something very small. In a deep state of samadhi, you are already so pure, right? Incredibly pure. There's no defilements there. There's hardly any sense of self left at all. Tiny, tiny amount of self left. Very, very little. And because of that, it almost looks like an awakening experience. It's very hard to distinguish between the two. And if you meet somebody who attains samadhi on a regular basis, they will look like almost like an arahant, and you won't really be able to tell the difference if they attain that samadhi regularly. So you have to be very, and they will argue that there is no self, because to them this is really beyond self. And the reason for that is because one of the greatest, one of the most important places where the self adheres to is the activity, the doing of the mind, right? I am the doer, I am the activity, I am the one who is behind all these actions. And because that is the main aspect of identity for most people, when you go beyond that, it appears as if you have reached a state of complete non-self. But actually, perhaps you haven't. I'm just suggesting that. Perhaps you have. Perhaps there is something more profound than that. So I'm just saying that it is very profound, very difficult to say. What you really have, you have to investigate people for a very long period of time with great care to be able to see what actually really is going on. And the Buddha gives some nice advice about this in the suttas. He says that if you want to know if somebody is virtuous, you have to stay with them for a long period of time and observe them for a long period of time, right? You don't really, nobody here knows me that well, right? I come here, I sit up here, I talk a little bit, and some of you have seen me for a few years, but it's very hard for you to really know 100% how virtuous am I? Maybe I'm a real scallywag behind the scenes, right? It's very hard to really be absolutely sure of that. And so because of that, you have to be very careful before you make claims about things. And this is also very much true when it comes to the sphere of wisdom. How wise is somebody else? You have to be with them for a long time. You have to be wise yourself to be able to evaluate somebody else's wisdom. You have to be perceptive. You have to have awareness. And it has to happen over a long period of time. You have to have discussions with them back and forth. So it is a very difficult thing. And this is also one of the reasons that when I hear people say this person is enlightened, that person is enlightened, I'm almost always very skeptical. Okay, the Buddha, I accept that the Buddha is enlightened, right? Okay, that I accept, because otherwise there is really nothing. But otherwise people say, oh, this monk is enlightened, so and so. And to be honest with you, I just don't know. Maybe they are, maybe they're not. It's just so hard to say. But it's too easy to be gullible. And very often there will be a large amount of people who say, oh, this person is an arahant. But just because a large amount of people say, I don't buy that. That's not enough for me, because it is so easy to be deluded. Once somebody gets a good reputation, everybody kind of piles in there and says, yeah, I believe too that the person is an arahant. And then people say, oh, you've got to be careful what you say. If he's an arahant and you say he's not, you're making bad karma. Right? So people are afraid of actually talking about their real feelings. And everybody says, oh, yeah, he's an arahant, because of fear, rather than because of any real perception of what is going on. This is one of the things, when you've been a monk for a long time, you've seen too much of that kind of stuff, and you start to become very much more reserved, not skeptical, but you reserve your judgment much more than you used to before, and you trust your own judgment more and more as time goes by. You say, okay, when I see it with my own eyes, then I will have more faith. So this is really the way to do things. Observe, be careful, don't buy into things too quickly. And slowly, gradually, you start to uncover and see if there's something really worth having faith in, having confidence in there. And as you see that, you feel that you are on solid ground. Of course, the problem is that you have to have some wisdom yourself, right? What if you are completely, what if you haven't got any wisdom yourself? It makes it very hard, right? So you have to kind of base yourself on something. But in the end, you have to trust your own judgment, because there is nothing else. Sometimes I hear people saying, oh, I don't trust my own judgment, so I listen to other people, what they have to say. But how do you know? You have to trust your judgment to listen to them, right? How do you know who to listen to? In the end, it always comes back to your judgment. So you have to trust yourself. And this is just the way it has to be. So be careful. Don't have too much hubris. Don't go around shouting about who is awake and who is not. Because these things are very hard to know. Be a bit humble about these things. But trust your judgment nonetheless. And then you are, I think, heading on the right track. So I can't say anything certain about this without kind of meeting these people myself. But as I said, I tend to be at least reserve my judgment on these things. Anyway, so there you are. That's my reply to that one. So there you go. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, what is the difference between volitional formations, in other words, willed activities, conditioning consciousness, and clinging upadana, conditioning existence, bhava? These seem very similar to me. Yes, that's exactly right. That was kind of one of the observations I was trying to make, because independent arising, you have... you are kind of in two places. You are moving from one life into the next one. So the conditioning process there is the same, but it is using slightly different terminology. And that can be very useful to use different terminology, because it shows you different angles, different aspects of the same process. So it is here quite similar. So the process of craving, right, tanha, upadana, attachment, bhavaha, existence, and then jati, rebirth, is very similar to the sequence avidya at the beginning, delusion, sankhara, willed activities, and then vijnana, which is the rebirth consciousness. So these two things are basically the same thing, but from different perspectives. That's why it's good to go through all the 12 links, because it gives you different perspectives on the process of dependent arising. Okay. Dear Ajahns, do Sotapannas get reborn in the human realm? If so, do they still remember their previous life at birth? Thank you. Yes, they can get reborn in the human realm. That is possible. Do they remember their previous life at birth? Probably not. Probably they don't. I don't think there is any evidence that they have to do that. It's very, very rare, very hard to remember your previous life at birth. So most likely, I would say not. But the point is that when you become a stream enter, you've had an insight into the teachings of the Buddha. Teachings of the Buddha, but basically what it means is an insight into the reality of things, right? That's really what it means from a Buddhist point of view. You have seen the nature of the mind, the nature of the body, and that has made an imprint on your mind, an imprint that is so strong it can never go away again. So that imprint, you carry it with you from one life into the next one. And even if you don't remember that thing that happened in the past life, the seed will be there inside of you. So you will kind of have some idea what you're supposed to do, how you practice. You will still be heading in the right direction, because your mind has been permanently altered permanently changed. You are different from other people in the world. You look upon the world in a different way. You see things differently. And for that reason, you tend to be moral. You tend to be a good person. You tend to think in the right way. And then, therefore, advance your practice. And that's why you only have 7 lifetimes at the most. 6 once you are reborn here. Okay. Dear Ajahn Ramali, does the mind follow the next rebirth? If it doesn't, where did past memories come from? Many thanks for all the fine, wise teachings of the suttas. Okay, so does the mind follow the next rebirth? If it doesn't, where did past memories come from? Basically, the mind is what basically goes from life to life, right? The mind is what kind of carries on the stream of consciousness, as it's called in the suttas. And that stream just moves on from life to life, and there is a continuity in that stream, not identity, but continuity. And that is very easy to understand just from the present life. Your life here, there is, you identify as somebody. There is no absolute identity between who you are now compared to who you were 20 years ago, 10 years ago, 30 years ago, whatever. There's no absolute identity, but there is a certain degree of continuity there. There's also change. So change and continuity kind of go together. And this is true in this life, and it's also true across lives. The same principle applies across lives as applies within this life. Right? So in the same way that you can remember things in this life, in the same way you will be able to remember things across lives. It's the same mechanism that works. Exactly how that memory works, that's kind of, the Buddha doesn't really talk about that. The Buddha doesn't philosophize very much. He often doesn't explain how things exactly work. You know, people often ask, where are they stored, these memories? Where do they, how does it all work out? And maybe they aren't stored anywhere. Maybe you access them in a different way. I'm not sure how that works, but memory works in this life, and also it works across lives. And there is, as far as I know, people who study the brain and neuroscientists, they haven't really found a place in the brain as such where memories are stored. They can't really find that. I think the memories are just part of this mental process that goes on. And that's where the memories somehow linger in there, and you access them through association or whatever. So that's how you can remember these things. So just like you memorize things in this life. So you see yourself, right, traveling around, going from one life to the other one, this way and that way, experiencing all these things, right? Doing the same, making the same mistake again and again and again. Oh, enough. That's what happens when you see the past lives. Anyway, so there you are. Okay. Next one. Dear Bhante, thank you so much for your lookout on this difficult topic. It changes so much for me. Okay, good. So that's great. So excellent. That's a very easy question to answer for me here. Wonderful. Okay, thanks for the good feedback. And we'll go on to the next one. Dear Ajahn, what is more important, living a virtuous life or to do meditation? As you've taught, these are interrelated. But please explain, is there a cause for good meditation, and is this living a virtuous life? Yes. The answer is yes. What is more important? Well, remember, the foundation of meditation practice is good virtue, right? Being kind, being a good person, having a good heart. Virtue does not mean just abstaining from the bad things. It also means doing the good things. This is really the foundation in all of Buddhism, all of spiritual teachings. So that is the most important thing here. Right? So be virtuous, be kind. This is what really matters the most. So if you have to choose, should I be a bad person who meditates, or should I be a good person who doesn't meditate? You should be a good person who doesn't meditate. That's definitely the answer. Don't be a bad one who meditates. You can't really be a bad one who meditates anyway, because the meditation is not going to be real meditation. It's going to be what they call Mickey Mouse meditation. So don't do that. So the foundation is always to be kind. That is by far the most important thing here. So if you feel that you, if you ever have to choose, you shouldn't really have to choose because you can usually do both. But the most important thing is the kindness. And in a sense, if you put a lot of effort into that kindness, into changing your perception of people, having more metta, more friendliness, more kindness towards everybody, more compassion, more understanding, right? Your mental outlook changes. And from that changed mental outlook, you're also more kind in speech, more kind in actions and everything. Then it will have tremendous impact on the meditation practice. It will really have enormous impact. As I was reading out the very first day, you may recall I was reading out the psychology of meditation, how you go one step after the other, right? You have joy in the mind, happiness, tranquility, joy, rapture, tranquility, happiness, samadhi, stillness, etc., one after the other. And all of that is based on one thing. It's based on sila, your character, right? Having a good character, a good heart is kind of the foundation of everything. Everything comes from that. So that is really where the most emphasis should be placed on that. And then meditation is a bonus that arises. A good meditation arises a bonus from that basic good character that you're developing for yourself. So yes, very, very interrelated and very important. And that's why when you ever hear meditation being taught, but sila is not taught, then it is not going to take you very far. I mean, meditation may always be helpful to some extent, right? It makes you feel a bit more relaxed and all that, but it's not going to go very far. This is why these things go together. Okay. Dear Ajahn, please help. I can get into very deep and pleasing states where my entire body feels happy, joyful, delightful, and I can let go of the breath and watch that. Then I can let go of watching the physical experience and watch the mental experience of it, the emotional feeling. I can narrow my focus to one aspect for an hour or two, but then what? I can't seem to go deeper or more narrow with mega metta. Okay. This sounds good, right? It sounds like you're heading in the right way. Things are going really well. You're watching that and things are narrowing down. Your experience is becoming quite simple. And you're feeling good about it. You're having some happiness. So basically everything seems like you're doing the right thing. So basically you just have to do more of the same, right? You keep on doing these things. The point is that these things, they develop over time. And the reason you can't go any deeper is because, as I was saying before, there is some hindrance there blocking you from going deeper. There's some attachment, something you're holding on to, something that doesn't allow you to gain an even deeper experience. But already you're doing very well, right? This is great. So just enjoy that. And the more you enjoy that, and the more you see the delightful aspect of that, the more content you are with that, the less interesting will be the external world. The less interesting will be the five senses. So the enjoyment in meditation is also what counteracts your attachment to the world outside. So just enjoy that. Wow, this is actually really wonderful. Let me just be content with this. And as you do that, gradually the other things that block you will fall by the wayside and disappear. And you will, your meditation will gradually improve even more. But you're doing really well already, right? This is great. And there are some people have been telling me about the meditation practice in the interviews, and people having good meditation. That's wonderful. That's why we're coming here for. So be happy with that. Be pleased with that. Deepen your contentment even more, and gradually it will go in the right direction. Remember that these things are not something that you can control. You can't make the meditation become even deeper. This often happens according to their own causes and conditions. When the time is ripe, then it will go deeper. And very often you just have to learn to be content and pleased with what you have. If you are able to see your mind clearly, to see where there might be an attachment holding on, sometimes you get a glimpse of that, then you can maybe do something to counteract that. Right? If you see that there is a problem with you know, some kind of attachment to the body, and remind yourself that, well, this body is going to die anyway one day. One day you're going to have to give it up. So give it up now, right? Now is the time to give it up. Let it all go. It doesn't matter. This is just a training exercise for when it really happens. And of course, you never know when it's going to happen. So, yes, something like that. So see how it goes. And if you want to ask any further about that, you can maybe ask later on. Okay. Oh, okay. Here we have an essay. Okay. Yeah, and it ends. Sorry for writing so long. Okay, no, that's fine. It's not that long, so I'm sure we shall be able to get through this. So, dear Ajahn Brahmali, a few months ago I did a hypnosis session with a well-known person from the BSWA. Okay, I think I may know who that is. During the session, I had an experience as a floating being, and I was above a particular tree. I had a walking sensation on the treetop, but I didn't have a body. The hypnotist asked me whether I was a man or a woman, but I didn't feel any gender, and I replied to him I wasn't man or female, and I didn't have a body. That felt great. The hypnotist asked me whether I wanted to give a hug for that tree, because he knew I loved nature. And that time I had a nimitta experience, my whole mind filled with bright white light and the yellow golden rays on it. I have never experienced a nimitta before during the meditation. Later I discussed this with the hypnotist about this, and he said white color nimitta is the purest one, but I have doubts about this. As Abraham used to say, usually color depends on our perception, etc. One, as Abraham says, to experience a nimitta has to go through the breath, beautiful breath, etc. How can someone experience a nimitta spontaneously like this? You can. It doesn't have to be through the breath. The breath is usually the most powerful way of experiencing nimittas. You can experience these things spontaneously. Nimittas come not from the breath. They come from the joy and happiness and the stillness and the power of the experience. That's where they come from. The breath is really irrelevant. The breath is just a vehicle to take you there. But the vehicle is not necessary. There are other ways of getting to that point. And I remember there was one, I told this story here before, but it was one woman. She was originally from Vietnam, and she had come to Australia. And because she came from Vietnam, she had a lot of faith in Kuan Yin, right? Kuan Yin, one of the important kind of Buddhist bodhisattvas in Vietnam. And she told the experience that when she came into this monastery in Melbourne, was there for the first time. She didn't know where to go, so she looked through and she looked around and she saw the Kuan Yin statue over there. So she walked over to the Kuan Yin statue, and as she bowed down to the Kuan Yin statue, she said she saw this blinding sun, this blinding light, right? And she said she tried to cover her hands over her eyes because the light was so strong. She didn't know whether she could take it. But even when she put her hands over her eyes, the light remained there. And she was just completely blissed out and happy, just bowing down to this Kuan Yin statue. That was a classic example of the nimitta arising just because of the occasion. She had come to Australia, she came to this monastery, she recognized Kuan Yin, and she felt so happy at that situation. The nimitta arose as a consequence. So it doesn't have to happen through the breath. It can happen in any situation where these things kind of come together. The emotions, the feelings, the peace, the feeling of being lifted up in a certain way. Right? So certainly it can happen in this way. And from the way you explain this, it sounds like a very genuine experience. Question number two. I also have read some articles about near-death experiences. Most of them see the nimitta as a white light. Is there any particular reason for that? Okay, so that is a wonderful story. So you have no reason for saying sorry for writing so long. It's a very beautiful story and very worthwhile telling. So thank you very much for that. The experience that people have when they die is often the kind of tunnel experience, right? And they have seeing a light at the end of the tunnel. I am not 100% sure myself whether it is a nimitta or not, because a lot of the people have this kind of experience. Maybe sometimes it is, maybe sometimes it isn't. But I'm not 100% sure if it is, and maybe something else apart from that. Does it have to be white? I don't know if there has been any studies if that white all that light always is white. Maybe sometimes it isn't. I'm not sure if the studies are detailed enough even to capture that kind of detail. But I don't know if there is any particular reason why it is white. And I think you're right. You have spoken to the master himself when you speak to Ajahn Brahm. He is the one who has the most experience with these kind of things. And he says that nimittas can come in different shapes and colors and all kind of things. Then you can take it that given that is the case, because he has a lot of experience with these kind of things. So that is probably the case. So I hope that helps. And there you are here. Okay, dear Ajahn, could you please remind people not to have their mobile phones in the meditation hall? Even when on silent, they still disturb the peace. Okay, so please be careful with the mobile phones and maybe turn them off completely or whatever. That is the request here. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, where I came from, there is this thing called Advanced Medical Directive. Okay, AMD, Advanced Medical Directive. It gives the hospital the authority to remove the organs of deceased persons who have healthy organs and transplant them to the living who need them. This saves lives. In Buddhism, we believe in the last thought driving rebirth, and that our consciousness must not leave the body immediately after we are certified death clinically. A friend of mine, therefore, distributes forms to fellow Buddhism to opt out of the AMD. This is so that we would not feel pain or anger when we are cut up to have our organs removed and get reborn in the lower realm. Is it doing the right thing? What shall Buddhists do? Okay, this is an interesting question, and it's quite a difficult one to answer, because quite right, as long as the body is alive, right, the body is there still living, it is quite likely that consciousness is still attached to the body somehow. And it may be the case that if the consciousness is still there, and then somebody starts to remove the organs, you are not going to be too happy, right? You're going to feel, wait a minute, I'm still here. You know, what are you doing? Taking away. I need these organs. They're mine. You can't just take them away like that. you can see that happening. So there is. I think there is some reason there for being a little bit careful. But of course, there comes a point when the consciousness does depart from the body. And that will be, you know, just before they finally die or at the point of death, roughly then. So if you take the organs just exactly at the point of death, then it should be fine. If you take them before that, it's a little bit more uncertain what is going on. So I think that there may be some grounds for being a little bit careful there from the point of view of the dying process in Buddhism. But it's a difficult topic, and I must admit, I'm not entirely sure what would be the right thing to do in these kind of cases. So unfortunately, I cannot give you any final authoritative answer on that one. That's the best I can do. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, I really have trouble getting up early in the morning to meditate. This happens more at home, but also when on retreat. This is really difficult when it is cold and dark outside. And I just want to give in to my desire to sleep. What do you suggest I do to overcome this hindrance? Okay, what do I do to meditate? I always feel much brighter and happier afterwards. Okay, So what do I do to get up to meditate? I always feel much brighter. Well, that's a good reason already to do it, right? The fact that you feel brighter and happier afterwards. If you do, that is a good reason to get up earlier. So what can you do to get up, to really get up early and do these things? Well, you know, you have a heater in your room, right? So if your room is nice and warm when you wake up, you can have a shower first thing in the morning to make sure you're nice and warm. And then when you go outside, you won't feel the heat, feel the cold so much and the rain so much. And that is just, you know, to start off straight away, not to kind of get into the cold straight away. That is one way of doing that. And then when you eventually get out, you'll be fine. I remember when I grew up in Norway, sometimes it was minus 20 outside. And you had to go outside. You were kind of a little kid, right? You had to go to school. It was minus 20. And you had to, in the dark, it was pitch black, because this is in the Northern Hemisphere, pitch black. And you had to walk for half an hour in minus 20 degrees to get to school. So compare it to that, right? If you compare it to that, it doesn't sound so bad. It's all relative. Everything is relative in this life. So, okay, good luck. See what happens. See what you can do. Dear Ajahn, it seems that everything is impermanent. Well, you have that's very that is very clever of you. So you're onto something there. Is there anything that is permanent? Is Nibbana permanent? Nothing is permanent. Is nothing permanent? But nothing is permanent, but nothing is impermanent, but nothing is permanent. Thank you, with metta. Something like that. Okay. Well, the Buddha says, sabbe sankhara anicca, all conditioned phenomena are impermanent, right? So that means that everything you know, in this world is a conditioned phenomenon. It has arisen into existence because of causes and conditions. Everything is the five khandhas, everything is our experience, and everything in our experience is always changing, always becoming otherwise. So yes, you are definitely on the right track there. Is there anything that is Nibbana permanent? Well, the question, we have to remember, what is Nibbana? Nibbana is the ending of things. So what you're asking of, is the ending of things permanent? Once you kind of attain Nibbana, is it possible to come out again afterwards? Maybe that's what the question then becomes. Nibbana is, once everything ceases, comes to an end, it doesn't come back again. The cessation, once it happens, is kind of final. Otherwise, you have come back to suffering again, right? The whole point is that once you attain this happiness, whoa, that's it. You are happy. And that's why this path works in this way here. So the ending of all sankharas is once they all end, that is kind of permanent, right? And then the ending of suffering, it doesn't re-arise again afterwards. That's really what it means. No re-arising of suffering again. Suffering has been ended for good. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, sometimes I am not sure of the differences between karma and kamma. What is the difference between karma and kamma? Karma is our actions referring to the cause and effect or the law of kamma. But kamma is desire, isn't it? Okay, I know what you're on about. Okay. Sometimes I hear teachers' explanation which seem to use the two interchangeably. Can you please explain whether the two are the same or different? Finally, what drives rebirth, karma or kamma? Thank you. Okay, what you mean is not, your spelling isn't perfectly right. That's why it was a bit confusing to me, because the two words that you're talking about here is actually the same word. Karma is Sanskrit form, kamma is Pali form. The word you actually mean is kamma. Kamma has only one M, and it has a long A, an A with this little bar across it at the top. That is the right word. And yes, there are two different words. Karma means all the actions we do. That is what drives rebirth, right? All the actions that accumulate and then eventually gives rise to a particular level of consciousness, and you get reborn accordingly. Karma is sensual desire. Karma is the sensual world. Karma loka, karma Dhatu, the world of sensual objects, the sensual world. It's basically the world we live in, right? Right now, this is Kamaloka. All of these are sensual objects around us, or sensory objects. You see things, they make a sensory impact on you. You either like them or you don't like them, right? That is karma. And karma is one of the things that we're trying to overcome, right? We're trying to let go of all the sensory impressions, trying to let go of all the desires for those all those objects in that world, and then we can enter into deep meditation. So these are two quite separate things. One that we're trying to let go of, and as we let go of that, we are all making, as we let go of karma, we're making better kamma or karma as a consequence. So heading in the right direction. So there you are. So I hope that makes sense. And if not, please try again tomorrow night. Last question for tonight. Dear Ajahn, if dependent origination, name and form is one item in the link, and yet its components, the five aggregates, are also separate items in the links. How should we understand this? And is perception, is it equal to contact? Thank you. Okay, so the idea is that in the link number four, that's where you find Namarupa, right? Name and form. From consciousness comes name and form. Link number four. And that should be understood as a general Namarupa. When you get reborn in the realm, then there is a certain limits on the Namarupa, on the experiences you can have. Your experiences are bounded depending on that realm. If you are a human being, there are certain limits to the experience you can have. If you are in a heavenly realm, those experience, the limits on those experiences will be different. If you're in a jhana realm, it will be different again. So each kind of realm, each type of rebirth will set limits on the kind of experiences you have. So Namarupa is kind of set in that way by where consciousness stations itself in the future life. It's called this, often called, one way of looking at it is the stations of consciousness. So this is a general thing, right? A very general idea of Namarupa. It has certain broad limits to it. And those limits will then stay in place for that entire life. Roughly, those limits will be there. You can still maneuver and change within those limits, right? You can change your existence as a human being for the better or for the worse, but within those limits. Now, the rest of dependent origination, what it does, it shows you how these aggregates work on specific occasions, right? So one thing is the general setting, and one thing is how they work on specific occasions. So on a specific occasion of contact, right? I see the ceiling, that's contact. I'm seeing the ceiling here. That's contact. I feel something. I feel the ceiling, is it nice or not nice or neutral, or something like that. And then I crave, oh, I want to see more of this beautiful ceiling. Right? So this craving arising. And because of craving, I get attached to the ceiling or whatever. You know, I'm just making this up as I go along. And then you exist kind of in accordance with your attachments. Of course, you're not going to attach to the ceiling, but just to giving you a silly idea. So this is like a specific instance of how this whole process works, right? It works like that. So you see the five khandhas in action from moment to moment or over long periods of time. And that is really the difference between the two. Perception, is it equal to contact? Contact is just used to mean the meeting, you know, the eye is there, a certain form is there, and consciousness is present to be aware of something. At that point, contact happens, experience happens, it's one moment of experience. And that contact can only happen when you are aware of something, you're paying attention to something, and a particular form comes into the range of the eye. Right? I can only see what is in this room. I can't see anything outside because I'm in the wrong place to see what is outside. So only certain things can be contacted when you are here in this place. So that is what it is. And of course, part of that contact, part of every experience is perception. That is part of that. So you contact something and then certain perceptions can arise depending on that contact. So when I sit here, certain perceptions can arise, certain feelings can arise, certain will to do something, right? and can arise as a consequence of this. And so that is really what it is. So perception is part of contact. Contact is just one way of understanding experience. We're trying to kind of make sense of how these things work. Yes? So if I do not answer your questions properly, or I forget something, or I haven't really understood what you're trying to say, you are always welcome to try again, of course, tomorrow, or the day after, or whenever you like. So that is the last question for tonight. So have a nice night again, sleep well, and get up early tomorrow morning, even though it's a bit colder. And let's just do the Arahant Sammasambuddha together.